Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Hi everyone. Yes, we are all wired up and ready to go. That's great. I'd like to welcome you all here to Worried Sick Living in the Age of Anxiety, which is a slightly anxiety-provoking title in some ways. We're talking about anxiety and we'll be for the next hour, it's not going to be, I'm afraid, the more therapeutic discussion of anxiety so much as anxiety and how it is bleeding into the wider world, personal anxiety and how that's feeding into kind of our culture and our governments. My name's Sophie Cunningham, by the way. I know that something that William Davies writes in his book Nervous States, that he talks about the history of the notion of the mind and body being separate, and then the fact that, so that was what, 300, I don't know, when was Descartes?
1630s.
Yes, so that kind of became a useful way of thinking about the world for a lot of people, but that understanding of how we are in the world is really changing and what's both breaking down, but also we're realising, I think, how much a strong relationship there is between the mind and the body, and that boundary is a slightly artificial one. And so I wanted to talk about this idea of collapsing boundaries and how they might be sort of creating some of the public anxieties that we're all experiencing today. I know William talks about this in terms of war and peace, the kind of history of the idea that you're in a state of war or state of peace. And this has been on my mind because, was it 2 days ago, the UK government declared a climate change emergency, and which puts the UK on a war footing. I don't really quite understand what it means, but it's certainly very dramatic language. Marina writes about many things in her book Insomnia, including the kind of porousness that one feels when one is lying in a state of insomnia. And Olivia talks a lot about public versus private spaces and writes about the way in which the difference between the two states can feel like they're collapsing, but also she writes really well about the rage that's directed at writers who insist on keeping those spaces separate. I mean, that's the discussion of Ferrante was really... Eleanor Ferrante in your book was interesting to me because you talk about she's quite good at being ritual. She's very good at being clear. There is this anonymous person and there's this public persona, and people are quite distressed, in a way, angry that she has put up those boundaries. So, Marina, I was actually going to ask you to read first, if that's okay. I don't think I warned you that I was going to ask you to read first. I'm sorry. Because I want each of our writers, Marina Benjamin, William Davies, Olivia Sujic, are going to... The books mesh together really well. They're also quite different, and they're also... I'm not just spruiking. All the books are quite extraordinary, and I was very affected, in a way, by working towards presenting this situation, this panel, because I was so interested by all their work. So I really wanted people to read so we could get a sense of the particularities of their work, though in the discussion we'll be talking much more broadly about the connections between their work. So, Marina, could you read, and then I'll sort of ask a question that will lead from your reading.
I suppose I just need a couple of words of introduction. Yes. About the passage that Sophie's asked me to read. I was talking about how when you're awake at night in your bed, you're islanded in your insomnia, and your bed is a kind of raft that takes you across the sea of night. And I've always had a kind of island-dwelling fantasy, and that fantasy, for me, took root very early on in the figure of Robinson Crusoe. But now I'm so there's a little digression in the book where I'm riffing on the Crusoe story. And I'll read a couple of paragraphs from that. Defoe wrote his story amid the heyday of a new mercantile age, working via its simple premise, man marooned, man survives, through every motif that would come to characterize the Enlightenment. Crusoe is the lone white crusader, transporting civilization with him wherever he goes, even unto the ends of the world, where he comes face to face with himself alone. He cultivates the wild with missionary zeal and brings order to chaos. He is industrious, indefatigable, and ingenious. What keeps him awake at night are productive thoughts about what he might make or do next, or record in his diary the day following. Crusoe does not merely pass the time, he positively consumes it. Robinson Crusoe came out 1719 on the heels of a century-long campaign that saw Dutch, English, French, and Portuguese and Spanish merchant ships colonize faraway lands for trade, exporting gunpowder and measles in exchange for sugar, coffee, and gold. In many ways, the novel models that century. Defoe's fictional hero echoes the European trader's conquistadorial sense of himself as the light in the darkness, and he contains within him all the other good qualities that Enlightenment thinkers set in opposition, one against the other, as if at war. Consciousness versus the unconscious, day versus night, magic versus reason, and wakefulness versus sleepy ignorance. In Defoe's novel, that quality of dopey ignorance resides in Friday, the savage whom Crusoe takes under his wing and educates. But in reality, this sleepiness of mind was embodied in the figure of the slave. The sorry truth and guilty secret behind European civilization, the unimaginable wealth it accrued to itself, is that it was purchased on the back of a vast colonial machinery that systematically invaded the dark continents and enslaved their peoples, creating an international economy built on enforced labor. The entire enterprise rested on the premise that the black body was unquestionably inferior, both ignorant and expendable. And this so-called ignorance was understood as having kept black people in a kind of perpetual night. But there is a doubling down of darkness involved in this equation, more unforgivable still, in that the brutalities of slavery were carefully hidden from a growing consumer class back home in Europe, so dazzled by the brilliance of sugar, its medicinal qualities, its ability to preserve foods and ferment alcohol, not least the sheer sweet delight of its crystalline granules melting on the tongue, that it could no longer see.
And which is a really wonderful passage in a wonderful book, but you go on to talk about, how, I think a couple of paragraphs later, about sugar, coffee, the kind of all these products which in fact fuel the state of insomnia. And what I wanted us to maybe talk about is the idea that capitalism is quite the state, and capitalism is actually quite invested in anxiety, sometimes consciously, sometimes it's just a sort of a symptom of other other decisions that have been made. I don't have a sense of who should sort of leap in and answer that question, but.
May I say just a yes. couple of words and open it up? I mean, it seems to me that, this is why I wanted to bring in capitalism, that capitalism not only has an investment in our productivity, it has an investment in our private lives. It wants to regulate our private lives. It demands to know if we're well enough, if we're fit enough, if we're sleeping properly. And it has produced all kinds of devices whereby we can have a metrics on this. So, you know, Fitbit, sleep aids, all the wellness literature. There's an entire industry about on self-regulation, which is aimed at curing our anxiety. But I would argue, and I wonder what Olivia and Will would make of this, I think only increases our anxiety. And I also think that this new economy, you know, you could even maybe call it a kind of neuroeconomy, is very gendered, and maybe that's something we can talk about too, because I think that men's anxiety expresses itself in certain ways societally, perhaps as a wanting to control things, perhaps wanting to kind of create certain societal constructs that kind of contain and are containing and controlling. Whereas I think women tend to turn their anxiety inwards and cannibalise themselves.
I do think that we are going to talk about gender and anxiety and discussions of anxiety, and I think that's a sort of almost a separate. I'm not quite sure what the ticking is. It's earrings. Right, okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Going back to the beginning of what Marina was saying in terms of obviously how, well, and as you were saying, how capitalism is invested not just in our productivity but in our anxiety, although arguably our anxiety fuels our productivity in certain ways, I very much felt like in writing this book that a part of what I was looking at was, because it's unavoidable, is obviously social media, and that is widely documented, but often the kind of the statistics and whatever that we have to look at that doesn't necessarily mean that we can say that it's definitely damaging our mental health. But what it definitely suggests is that the kind of hypervigilant state that social media creates for us, whether it's, you know, using the same techniques as in gambling, whereby we have these unpredictable rewards, this kind of slot machine on our screens all the time to keep us in a permanent state of arousal, and therefore to kind of use it more and to distract ourselves more and feel guiltier and then feel worse and then need it more. And that same cycle of like gambling or addiction. But also that the force, when I was writing this book, I was thinking more and more about how the forces behind that are creating a place where, you know, if you think about self-harm, for example, there was a terrible, tragic case recently in the UK where a young, I think, 16, 17-year-old girl committed suicide after spending so much time on things like Instagram. And there's been a kind of uproar in, well, globally about what the responsibilities these platforms have. Are they publishers or are they just sort of platforms for other people's content? Where does their responsibility lie? But I definitely feel like they create these places where people go to maybe feel bad about themselves or share their anxieties and in some sense feel like they're being healed or cured or seen or made to... That feeling of sharing can alleviate some of this anxiety that we're talking about. But then obviously the levers that, whether it's like a Fitbit or any of those self-measurement types of things where you see yourself kind of, I guess,
as a data product,
these companies get rich off of your self-scrutiny and off of your anxiety. You create this content and then they store it as data, and that data is used to sell you more things, or they can sell that data on. So it's this quite sort of pernicious cycle that, and thinking about it makes you more anxious.
just a comment which I think links to what's been said, but to do with capitalism. And I think that it's worth thinking about the kind of capitalism that has developed in many Western societies since the 1960s, which is a type of capitalism where the ideal form of subjectivity or lifestyle is that of entrepreneurship. And I'm not against entrepreneurship, but it's worth reflecting on what it means to be entrepreneurial. And I think that the kind of injunction to be entrepreneurial is to be as flexible and as innovative as possible, to not expect the world to change in any substantial way, so therefore one has to change oneself. That if one loses one's job in one career, to completely reinvent oneself and go into a different one. And fundamentally, the kind of type of freedom that goes with an entrepreneurial society is a freedom that goes the whole way to the core of oneself, where every aspect of oneself can be changed. And that includes the way you present yourself on social media, which is in some sense a kind of branding exercise, that what most social media activity, and I use social media, so I'm not saying this in a sort of, some kind of snobbish way, but it is these are technologies which allow us to perform value in the eyes of others, to say, look, I am special, I am different, I am valuable, I am doing something that is worthy of attention and of an audience, which, of course, has all sorts of political effects where people drift towards more and more kind of unusual and extreme forms of statement in pursuit of that audience. But I think that psychologically, all of that adds up to a level of freedom that offers no type of sort of security or permanence, because ultimately every aspect of the self is up for grabs in some way. And I think that that is the message that we project towards younger people today. We tell them that when they go to university, and I'm an academic, the reason they've got to take on all of this debt is because they are making an investment in themselves as a piece of capital, which will pay them back over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And if they make a bad investment, they're going to have to suffer the consequences.
Each human being is a separate profit center, in effect.
Effectively, which yes. Is what, and yeah. they have to sort of decide what type of company to be, yeah. And then if it turns out that they make lots of money, then it was a good decision. If they don't, it was a bad decision, but they will have to live with the consequences of it.
And they're also a microeconomy, yeah. Which yeah. can be regulated, and that's where you have all the trappings of these metrics, where you know, we're in constantly being encouraged to police and regulate the self, this ever-shifting self. Mm. So no wonder we're in such a state.
I do want to talk more about social media and the political system, but before we do that, I also wanted to talk about time, and this does in a way link into the idea of hypervigilance and social media, but I think our sense of time is changing, and that is something that you referred to in your reading as well, Marina, but I was going to ask William to read something which is a bit about time, and us to talk, I'd like us to talk about how time, is changing, how much we are expected to be responsive in a really immediate way, more thoughtful approaches to living are less acceptable.
And let me just briefly say a little bit about, just to kind of introduce this, I suppose just a brief comment on what it means to be nervous, which is obviously in the title of my book. The nervous system is a crucial source of information and a basis for survival in society. But what it means to be too nervous is to be too attuned to the present. So it's what our nerves do is they tell us how I am right now. Am I hungry? Am I afraid? Am I happy? Am I comfortable? So that the nervous system is something that communicates the now. And to be excessively nervous is to have an excessive sense of the now, which I think ultimately starts to translate into a type of performance anxiety where people simply cannot go into an exam room or onto a stage or whatever it might be. So there is a crucial issue about temporality in different types of knowledge and different types of mood with which my book is concerned. So I'm just going to read a little bit about how I deal with that in relation also to violence in the book. In the second half of the 17th century, in the wake of civil and religious wars, states of war and of peace were held apart by a range of new institutions. But there is a limit to how successfully this division can be sustained, as the tools and psychology of war have gradually reappeared in economic, political, and civil institutions. War of one kind or another feels almost inevitable today. In some respects, such as cyber war and the full-spectrum strategic approach adopted by Russia, it is already underway. If peace is no longer so peaceful and war is no longer so warlike, could it be that war provides a more meaningful and more effective metaphor for addressing today's most pressing concerns? Might it be the time to take a leaf out of the playbook of the populists and nationalists and accept that we're all in a situation of quasi-war, albeit with very different forms of violence from those that Thomas Hobbes was desperate to eliminate from political life in 1651? Beyond reasserting facts and expertise, maybe the culture wars need to be joined from both sides. This isn't necessarily as frightening as it might sound. One immediate benefit of such thinking would be to relieve the pressure to establish a general public consensus around the facts. The primary concern in situations of war is to gather intelligence quickly and to ensure that it is actionable. Knowledge captured this way has no need of a public audience. Indeed, it often remains at the status of an unknown known or a secret. Its primary virtue is its sensitivity and immediacy. Meanwhile, public knowledge is geared to mobilize people as much as to provide factual reports. The hunger for a faster, more engaging politics is not about to abate. One question is whether it could be diverted towards something non-violent. While today we may feel ill-served when it comes to slow, thoughtful, reasoned debates of issues of the sort which emerged in the clubs and coffee houses of commercial Europe in the 17th century, we are only too well served by possibilities for rapid detection and analysis. Public debate might descend into irresolvable conflicts, but the intelligence powers of business, computing, and the military expand all the time. The good news is that, at least in terms of technical equipment, we could scarcely be more capable of dealing with the uncertainties and dangers of the Anthropocene. Even if consensus on nature and society seems further off than ever, coordination of responses is still eminently possible. We are endowed with a global information nervous system, allowing us to detect change and react at great speed. An example of this is how financial markets are harnessed as environmental policy tools, with new markets and derivatives in carbon being constructed in the hope that the sentiments and guessing games of the financial economy will spontaneously steer us towards a sustainable path. But this is not enough. And then it does go into a discussion of some of those themes that you mentioned of the climate emergency and this type of climate mobilization.
Yeah, that sense of we're in a state of crisis, we have to respond immediately. And that does kind of, it does create this sense of extreme alertness, which is really difficult to live with over a long period of time. Marina Olivia, yeah.
Actually, I just wanted to say, a part of why the UK government did that was because of the marches from things like Extinction Rebellion and those kind of things. And I was on a few of those marches and occupying the Waterloo Bridge at one point, because I'm a writer and I have a job, so I can go and sit on bridges. But I, funnily enough, because I have an anxiety disorder, being there on the bridge felt entirely different from sitting at home worrying about these things, because as you just mentioned, obviously our nervous system, the way that anxiety is supposed to function is to keep us alive, to tell us to avoid threats. That's why if you're living in constant danger or poverty or stress, you find it difficult to plan for the future and you find it difficult to think beyond the present because you're in fight, flight, freeze mode. But when you're not faced with an obvious threat right in front of you, that nameless dread just follows you into everything and it will kind of take whatever shape container you give it, which in my daily life with no borders between work or office or home or anything, literally is my whole life sometimes. So then going to, let's say, this protest and being kind of faced with exactly what the threat is made me actually feel much better, weirdly, because I was like, the anxiety that I'm feeling in my stomach relates to this problem, and that makes me, I guess, feel more like I'm about to go to war than I do like I'm feeling like I'm about to, I don't know, maybe have like an intruder break into my home because I have this weird sense of unnamed dread.
So in a way, it's giving you the chance to externalise that,
well, I think,
that state in a way that's really constructive.
And I think that's why public debate, etc., gets so polarised, so emotional and so, you know, ad hominem, or like all these attacks, is because people have this sense of dread and they want to put it somewhere, or they want to fixate on someone like Trump, whereas obviously he's just a orange beacon for all these other issues.
Marina, I don't know if this would be a good time to talk a little bit about the idea of collective dreaming and the way that feeds into...
Yes. So, I mean, I suppose my whole book is an exploration of how that dread that both Will and Olivia have been talking about invades us individually and actually contaminates our night. So it stops us sleeping, and we have that state of hypervigilance in the night, creating a kind of trespass of wakefulness. And I was really interested in exploring the various dimensions of that wakefulness, that nervous state that will never let us go. The mind won't let the body rest and go into sleep, and it's this permanent state of restlessness and enervation.
Inefficient use of time.
Inefficient use of time. But I suppose I was interested in probing that from different directions, and so the reading that I gave earlier came from a bit where I'm talking about isolation and loneliness, but of course, there are ways in which insomniacs always think about other people because they lie awake at night imagining all the other beacons of light, of awakeness, you know, across the globe, twisting and turning in their own beds. But another way, and a much less obvious way, in which there's a connection between these people all lying awake is the world of dreams. And in the book, when I talk about dreams, I was thinking, how can I write about dreams that just sidesteps the Freud as this kind of colossus who sits over the whole subject? What can I possibly say that might look at it from a slightly different angle? And I came across this book by an Austrian journalist called Charlotte Barat, called The Third Reich of Dreams. And Barat was a German Jew living in Austria in the 1930s. And when the Nazis came to power, she started having these horrific nightmares of being, as she put it, hunted from pillar to post, tortured, shot at, scalped. And she thought, if I'm having these dreams, if I'm assailed by these paranoias at night, I wonder if other people are too. So she began this project to start collecting dreams. And she smuggled these dreams, written in little bits of code, on bits of paper, and she smuggled them out of Austria. And later produced this book, where which records all the different ways in which the Nazi kind of oppression, of state of oppression, and the anxiety that created in society was being reproduced by people in their dreams. So they would dream, for example, you know, that the stove was listening to them or spying on them, or that the walls in their house suddenly disappeared and became transparent, or they'd believe that, or they dreamt that suddenly they'd start speaking in a language they'd never heard of before, so that they became unintelligible to the authorities and, of course, unintelligible to themselves. Anyway, I thought this was a really fascinating way into dreaming. And when my book came out, a psychotherapist in America wrote to me. Her name is Martha Crawford, and she had embarked on a project to see if Americans under Trump were also having collective dreams. And she collected 3,000 of these dreams because people were indeed dreaming about this kind of the oppression of having a kind of a very rigid, oppressive, totalitarian almost state. And I just wanted to share some of these with you because they're not only revealing, they're also quite entertaining.
Just maybe certainly the first one you read us.
Yeah, well, I'll share a couple maybe. But yeah. She collected 3,000, and this one is, I had a dream that I beat Donald Trump in golf, and he decided to deport me even though I was born here.
That's just brilliant in so many ways.
I dreamt Donald Trump was furious with NASA for refusing to turn the Hubble telescope back on Earth to spy on immigrants. This one's good. I dreamt that termites were eating the walls of my house and they all had tiny little Donald Trump faces.
I've actually had the termite dream, but without Donald Trump's face.
And what was interesting is, like Barat, Charlotte Crawford, Martha Crawford, found that she categorised these dreams, and they were dreams that fell into the categories of propaganda and surveillance, debasement and persecution, and apocalypse. That's a pretty hefty load to live with.
I wanted, to follow on from this, these various ideas, I wanted to ask you specifically about Trump, Will, because you do talk a little bit about the very particular kind of political debates, the way in which reason has sort of been abandoned for these kind of more contested ideas as a battlefield and slugging it out on social media without time for reflection, so time becomes part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, speed and time is crucial here. I think that, I mean, this is the great threat one of the great threats that someone like Trump poses to the way democracy has functioned in the modern age is that what Trump is almost uniquely able to do is disrupt the rhythm of public life. Because, and I mean, there are politicians, I think, in other countries, in Britain, Boris Johnson does this, where you sort of, there'll be a sort of rhythm of a debate, and then someone can just sort of drop a little grenade into it and completely disrupt it so that it can't carry on. And in that sense, it's sort of, it is in that respect, it has to be understood as violence, because what it is doing is it's violating the possibility of mutual understanding, which takes time. That to understand and to build agreement and mutual respect across differences is necessarily something that takes dialogue and is slow. And someone who comes along and can just sort of disrupt it by saying something outrageous or offensive or racist or whatever it might be, I think this is where the kind of violent nature of someone like Trump needs to be recognised. And I think, I mean, one of the sort of other kind of collapsing boundaries that, and we've been talking about various collapsing boundaries, one of the ones that kind of concerns me in the book is, and I've just said that this is kind of violent speech, and I mean that, but obviously it's not violence like throwing a punch. But that is another of the sort of uncertainties, anxieties of our age, which is I don't think we quite know exactly how to define the precise limits of violence. In the sense, and I think that, and of course that breaks out in sort of debates about free speech and hate speech and so on. But I think that these are sort of some of the kind of characteristic anxieties of our age, that the sort of boundaries where civil discourse ends and acts of violence begin are no longer as clear as they were, particularly in the kind of age of analog media.
And creating that kind of unpredictability and instability in public discourse is then what he capitalizes on and exploits by saying, I can be the strong man in this state of anxiety where you don't know who to trust and who to listen to, and you can't predict what, you know, there's no nice rhythm to politics, so you need me.
When Marina was talking about dreams and reading about dreams, I actually was thinking also of a section in your Exposure, your book, Olivia, where you talk about sort of a sort of paranoia that you're being surveyed, that the kind of window that people are looking at you when you're in an apartment, and that as Marina was speaking, that struck me, that's almost like a kind of dream of surveillance, isn't it? It's kind of, except you're awake, but you kind of have a strong sense of being surveyed. What I mean is, I think a lot of us have that slightly paranoid sense about, are we being watched?
I think that in parts of Exposure, I'm talking about how that's particular to a writer, because obviously you're constantly, or you try not to, but often you're thinking like how you will be received, how you'll be seen, and it's an asymmetric relationship. So like the lights are so bright, I can't really see any of your faces kind of thing. And that is the same when you put a book out in the world and, you know, Amazon reviewers can get all over it. Like, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but like little ants, and they can see you from all these vantage points that you can't see yourself in a way, and you don't get to have that kind of reciprocal intimacy back. So in the book, I talk about that feeling at night when a window becomes a mirror and suddenly you have this slight sense that maybe there's someone, could be someone right out there looking in. And that also, I think that's a metaphor for how this kind of paranoia about surveillance can turn us inward, can make us constantly self-scrutinize and worry about how we might be saying the wrong thing or looking the wrong way or appearing, you know, worrying that someone's going to do a, what do they call it, is it a rage excavation where they go back through someone's Twitter or whatever to find like the awful things they've said like 10 years ago. But in terms of how that obviously now relates to everyone, writer or not, I think, is that whether or not you participate in social media, whether or not you have a kind of presence there, because of data capitalism, we are all being surveyed all the time. You know, you can think you're not participating, but you walk down the street and you say, oh, I fancy a pizza, and then instantly your phone sends you like 10 different and this happens to me all the time. And like, so and what I find so insidious about it, apart from anything else, is that sense of being predicted as much as watched, so that you start to feel like your actual identity is being shaped by what people think that you want. So you like this, you will now read this, or whatever. And there's not that sense of serendipity anymore where you can just walk into a bookshop and pick something you like because you saw it.
And when you hit a certain demographic, particular things happen on social media. So the moment I turned 50, my Facebook was full of ads about menopausal snoring, It's like, okay, well, clearly the clock has ticked, and now that's the kind of, they're the kind of ads that are going to run.
And that anxiety that Olivia's talking about right now, the anxiety of surveillance, is literally an existential anxiety, because existentialism defines us by our ability to choose who we are, to define the self through our choices. Now we're having our choices defined for us by algorithms. So, you know, no wonder we're in existential crisis. What if the algorithm's choice about who you are doesn't actually resonate or chime with who you think you are? And that, when Will was talking earlier about Donald Trump doing violence, I was thinking, wanting to ask you something, Will, because I immediately thought of, he's not just doing violence, but it was just a related word that sprung to mind. He's also a violator, you know, the famous pussy grabber. You know, nothing is private with Donald Trump. So he'll do the act of violence, but then the violence will intrude on your own personal life. So that boundary is collapsed too, you know, and the surveillance is yet another violator of your personal integrity.
But I mean, that's Silicon Valley's ideology. I mean, you know, Facebook's slogan in its early years was move move fast and break things. I mean, that's what Donald Trump has also done. He moves fast and breaks things. And I think that, I mean, you know, it's astonishing, and the publishers will all celebrate me for saying this, is the way, you know, Google was just, when it wanted to copy every single book in the entire world, they just went ahead and did it. They didn't have permission. They didn't have the legal right to do it, I don't think. And they just did it. And that is the Silicon Valley ideology, is you, there's a boundary and you smash through it, and then later, by the time it's too late and you've got all the data, then you get on and do other things. And that's obviously how Uber wants to. Uber doesn't make a profit. What it does, it goes around trying to destroy municipal transport systems and assume that maybe the profit will come in 20 years' time. So it is a kind of a speed and violence of these things, and anxiety, I think, all do go together.
And yeah, so some of the things I was thinking about actually a lot in my first novel, that is why I sort of wrote Exposure, is that feeling of speed in the sense of pioneering, go west, like just do whatever you need to do to make, you know, in that capitalist sense. And how we're only, what I find so anxious making is that feeling like, has the horse already bolted? Is there still time to try and corral or like return to a state? Because obviously every single time there's a new form of technology, it generates huge amounts of anxiety. That's how we are programmed to be, is change in our environment makes us anxious. And when the novel first arrived, that generated huge amounts of anxiety in, you know, the 18th century, because people, in the, well, 19th century, basically, it's always been this sort of state of anxiety.
Change like, is anxiety.
Will women read a book about incest and also want to commit incest? Because, like, how can we trust women not to sympathise with evil characters and that kind of thing? And it was, like, seen as immoral to read novels. And so, obviously, that always happens. And I'm not, like, going around in my tinfoil hat acting like all technology is only for bad. But in this case, it's happened so fast that there's been absolutely zero time for reflection, and it's only happening now when the inventor of the internet, Tim Berners-Lee, is like, it may be too late to go back to the vision that I had, but, like, you know, oh, let's
this
try.
This was not my vision.
There's no, it's not like they started out with a Hippocratic oath. It's, you know, move fast and break things was basically the only slogan.
This, Olivia, I wanted to ask you to do a read from Exposure, a section which I liked enormously in your book, where you talk about ideas of subjectivity and gendered perceptions of subjectivity, just so we could, before we go to questions in about 10 minutes, we could talk a little bit about these kind of notions of the objective, the subjective, and reason. And
I'll just add to that, thank you for that summary. I think part of why I was talking about it is that, especially as a writer, but I think also what for me at least characterizes anxiety, is that inability to necessarily trust your own mind. It's not often that I feel anxious about an external objective. I mean, yes, that contributes to my anxiety, like will climate change, you know, end the world tomorrow? But actually often it's more like, can I trust my own instincts? Can I trust this worrying voice? Like, am I... And I think that's also a female experience. Like, am I actually just mad? So, and when you're a writer, I think that every day. Am I just mad? Why am I doing this? But I think that what obviously happens is, especially if you're writing fiction, you're not necessarily deeply entrenched in the real world. You're actively trying to kind of close yourself off. And in that isolation, that question of, like, should I trust my own inner voice gets worse, because studies show that the more isolation, or the more time you spend in isolation, the greater that sense of, like, hypervigilance grows, and you basically, it's a vicious circle. Anyway, so this was about subjectivity. Female experience tells you that the personal is political, while the world tells you there's something wrong with you personally and the system is fine. When white, cisgendered men write, even about their personal experience, they write about the human condition. And like the erroneous beige of flesh-colored tights, their perspective is deemed universal. Books written by women, about women, are not. That's women's fiction, for which category there is no male equivalent. As Chris Krauss explains of reclaiming the female I, as in I, even now, when women use the first person, it's perceived as a little sullied, compromised. No one blinks at the male eye because it is considered to be the universal. Male readers rarely think of female subjectivity as having the power to contain flashes of the universal, while women are used to reading male subjectivity that way. The late V.S. Naipaul commented on Jane Austen that he couldn't possibly share her sentimental ambitions, her sentimental sense of the world, and he also dismissed his publisher, Diana Athill, for writing feminine tosh. All fiction written by women, in fact, was inferior to that written by him due to female writers' narrow view of the world. In 2014, that was easier to dismiss as attention-seeking self-promotion. Now such misogyny has a presidential mandate, though the president doesn't read. His talismans, and I talk in this book about who my talismans are as writers, his talismans are a bookcase of his own ghostwritten books.
I suppose what I found myself thinking about when I was reading the books together, not just separately, is whether the is the fact that a lot of debates around expertise and objectivity do make particular groups of society feel left out. So in effect, expertise becomes gendered, not really, but in terms of perception, and there is this total abandonment. If you the refusal of expertise is one of the kind of keystones of the current political debate. I'm not quite sure if I'm expressing this clearly enough. Could you all kind of comment on this idea of expertise versus subjectivity and whether that's even meaningful to think about the world using those kind of terms? In a minute each, thank you very much. That was a joke, about a minute each.
I'll make a meta comment on it, which is about my commitment to subjectively writing about female experience. Yep. If you'd asked me 20 years ago, would I be campaigning to write about female subjectivity? I'd have said, no way! Yeah, I'm not confined by my body. I've got a mind. I'm ambitious, you know. But I think that the kind of the perils of essentialism that were beset us in the 80s have kind of drifted away to some extent, and I think that's opened up a space for women to really write subjectively. And I really have developed an allergy to any kind of nonfiction that is that pretends to expertise, really. I want to approach the idea from a position of not knowing, and I want not knowingness and ambiguity and uncertainty and all those things I think that are traditionally associated with female activity and subjectivity and fragmentation and contradictoriness. Those are the things I want to push front and forward in nonfiction. I think nonfiction should be subjective. I think it should be probing. So I sound like I'm campaigning here, but I mean, those are the commitments that I'm taking very seriously in this age of anxiety. Not because I don't respect experts, but because I think that having the answers to things can sometimes shut down debate. Yes. And I think that asking questions opens things up and is more honest. And Insomnia ended up being a really interesting vehicle for exploring that subjectivity, because it is all those anxious, fragmented, contradictory, contrarian things.
I mean, one thing which, just while Marina was speaking, I was just reminded of the fact that the term expert, we often forget, has the same root as the word experience. So actually, originally an expert meant someone who had experience. Now, of course, we all have experience, and therefore, in some sense, the whole boundary around who counts as an expert has always been politically constructed in various ways. Various lines get drawn around it by professional associations, by academic educational credentials, and so on. And there will be people who don't like that, and people, populists, who attack it, and so on. But there is, nevertheless, I think, something we should challenge, the kind of self-evident authority of expertise a lot of the time. And there are certain areas where I think that boundary has frayed in all sorts of ways, and one of which I talk a bit about in the book, is if you take kind of medical expertise, where in some ways we expect medicine to do more and more and more for us. We want to turn things like loneliness into a sort of medical pathology or something like that. We now have sort of in Britain some health policies to tackle loneliness as a sort of a health concern rather than as a social one. But then at the same time, if you take mental health as a domain of medical expertise, what does it mean to be an expert on mental health? Well, of course, there are people who can sort of tick off various symptoms and diagnostic categories and so on. But ultimately, the subjectivity of mental health and the experience of anxiety or depression or different experiences and so on, is you can't be wrong about about whether or not you're depressed. I mean, there are sort of questions about sort of, you know, to what extent does the authority of the medical experts still count? And if you look at what's happened in healthcare over the last sort of 50 years, really, is that the perspective of the patient has become more and more important in lots of ways, which means that there's far sort of, it's far vaguer to say what a diagnosis actually consists of because of the way in which experience of the sufferer has become much more sort of integral to how different conditions are understood.
I mean, you kind of nailed it, so. But I mean, so I'm trying to go back to what the original sort of question was, which was,
ways of thinking about subjectivity. Is it a kind of, which you kind of, you don't question subjectivity as important, but talk about the fact it's received in such a particular way it can be dismissed.
So I kind of agree with, I definitely agree with what Marina was saying, and obviously the type of book I've written is not pretending to expertise, it's a personal essay. But at the same time, I mean, so.
But there is a lot of expertise in it, in a really useful way. I mean, I think it opens it out.
What I guess I feel like is that perhaps I was obviously, for example, in the UK when Brexit happened, a classic kind of quote that now sort of sums up what we're talking about is Michael Gove saying the public have had enough of experts because they kept marshalling all these, you know, everyone from Ban Ki-moon to kind of the Archbishop of Canterbury saying this is going to be terrible and it's going to be an act of national self-harm. And it was very triggering to hear a politician who's a very smart academic type of politician say that we were going to disregard experts. But what he actually meant was we've had enough of them in the sense that they've been proved wrong and, you know, look at the banking crisis, etc. And what your book does so well, it's saying it's like we're missing the point if we're trying to appeal to people through experts. And what I do believe that there, and there should be things that are just incontrovertible facts. And I, you know, the earth is round, vaccines are good, all those kind of things. But I also feel like when you come into those debates saying, I am the voice of reason, and it often is presented, you know, as in the way to present fact is to be unemotional and to speak in a certain tone of voice that is, you know, I went to a rich or I have a privileged upbringing and I know how to speak in public and so on and so forth. And that conveys fact in a different way from obviously if you look at Dr. Christine Blasey Ford talking to I don't even want to say his name.
I like beer, but you know,
if you look at that, like if she'd had,
I don't know who you're talking about.
Oh, Kavanaugh in the Senate when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford was accusing.
Yes.
Yeah. And she was obviously so good at presenting her personal testimony in non-emotional terms, despite the fact that she was a trauma victim and a you know survivor, and also the fact that we now know that obviously people who've gone through that kind of thing tend to not remember parts, focus in on certain details, like it was wholly consistent. And then he basically wept and pointed to his beer diary and slammed the table and shouted and things like that. But that was still treated, in that case, it was like, see, he's emotional because it's true that he's really upset that he's been accused of rape. And then in her case, you know, oh, actually, maybe she's like cold and calculating and rehearsed and has been coached through this.
That's actually an extremely good example of the kind of theatre, I mean, the way all these issues are being acted out in the public eye.
But the assumption that we can ever pretend to expertise without also bringing our personal backgrounds, our lens on the world, and frankly, our emotions, I feel like the fallacy is to pretend that anyone presents expertise without actually having their own huge, vast world of their own emotions that are informing the way they talk. So like you say, not necessarily assuming that you're bringing the answers. You're saying, I'm coming from this angle. This is the way that I see things. I'm aware that that's... And that's why identity politics, I guess, is on the rise, is because... Well, there's lots of reasons, but I think that's a big part of it, is people in a kind of place of absolute relativism, post-truth, everyone needs to know who's the narrator, like who is, what, where are they coming from when they say this?
And it's also why identity politics challenges the establishment as well.
We've got 10 minutes for questions. I'm assuming people do have questions. We'll start here, thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question that sort of follows on from that last area of debate, and you were talking about answers shutting down debates. I wanted to pick up a bit on identity politics and when answers shut down debates, which people are shut out. And as a queer disabled woman, what can people like me, or what can people in minorities do to become part of this kind of bigger debate in this very heated and anxiety-inducing age?
Who would like to start? I mean, one of the ways in which I know that people do, people from different minorities do attempt to engage is through social media. So I think possibly one of the questions is whether that is a constructive way of people's voices being heard, or whether those voices actually end up getting shut down through trolling, for example, or the ways in which voices can be shut down. But that's one of the things that came to mind, that it is actually quite... Those forums are touted as a good space for those kind of conversations, but I don't believe they necessarily are a good space for those conversations.
I mean, that's certainly their potential for good, is to be this space where people who are normally not able to participate... And often in a physical sense, like I have got a friend with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and so she's literally like can't leave her flat. And so, when I harp on about the evils of the internet, she's like, I mean, come on, like that's how I engage so much with people. And so then I'm immediately back in my box. So,
I also think, you know, the flip side of not having experts is that identity politics, as Olivia was saying, but also more generally, subjectivities have a little bit of a window and an opening to kind of take a platform and say, you know, yes, we live in intersectional communities, and, you know, we've all expressed being in Australia, as Brits here in Australia, how much we've loved the ways in which the organisers of the festival have paid respect to the honour to the lands and the history of the Aboriginal possession of the land and the sharing of the land. And, you know, that would never have happened without the space for recognition of intersectional rights and identities and priorities and all those things that I think are the good side, the upside, if you like, of our difficult times.
And then, there is another question, but just a final point I wanted to make. There is also, I think, partly an issue of attention around time. That there's an urgency to these debates, but policy, bureaucracy, those things seem to take endless amounts of time. And so there's this incredible lag between when people are feeling most strongly about these issues before there's any kind of resolution, which doesn't mean that there's not some resolution down the track or some kind of proper discussion about these issues down the track. Once the issues have been raised, I mean. Yes, over here.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much, wonderful panel. I just want to pick up a point that Marina moved on, which was her campaign to have non-fiction that was ambiguous, subjective, etc. I mean, I take your point very much, but I'm also concerned that where is the place for rigorous scholarly research as well? And I'll give you a quick example of how I would like to defend that. In the late 60s, early 70s, a woman called Anne Oakley wrote a book called Housewife. Now, it was considered very bizarre that somebody would write on housework and totally not scholarly and academic, but she'd done scholarly work. She'd done solid research with a lot of women. So that gave her the, you know, credibility. Yeah.
Marina. I'll answer it very quickly, so give the other panellists a chance to say something. I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I do a ton of research behind my books. I just then decide that the angle that I'm going to take on them is going to be subjective, and then I put all the books that I've read, I put them in endnotes so you know where my research has come from. I just don't choose to write like an academic or like a scholar. That doesn't mean that I'm not interested in empirically grounding what I'm writing about. So I think that it isn't an either-or thing. I think, and what I'm objecting to is not factual robustness. It's the voice of authority and the idea that because I'm writing nonfiction, I will tell you what history is. We know that's not the case, precisely because of intersectionality and, you know, that whole idea of history being written, I'm picking on history here, but history being written by the victors. You know, we are now in an era where we actively go in search of the histories from the loser's point of view, or those voices that haven't been heard. So that was the point I was making, more than I'm a great respecter of facts, but I just want to approach my subjects. Having absorbed the facts, then I want to approach it subjectively.
I agree, and I think so Insomnia is a wonderful book, and I think what it does so well is draw together, you know, bits of history, bits of politics, bits of economics, bits of her own life, etc. And I think that, for me, is what I'm most excited about, in the way that even, you know, fiction is moving too. Like, a lot of the fiction I'm most drawn to is the kind of Maggie Nelson's, is the kind of bringing together in this collage-y like way and putting into alignment. And I think that's something that our 21st century consciousness is more and more able to do, because one of the things that social media does, for example, or even just our news feed, is to constantly require us to assimilate. So-and-so's had a baby, the girl you went to school with, there's been a terrorist attack in the same, you know, in the same feed. And it's very jarring, but what it does do is make our brains able often to assimilate, and also to make interesting connections when you place the fact next to the fiction. And those that bleeding of those boundaries I find really exciting.
I just wanted to quickly, because you just reminded me, I was thinking about this sort of what it means for scholarship and subjectivity to sort of live in the same space in the way that Marina was talking about. So it reminded me of an example that I talk about in my book, which is this project called Is This How You Feel? And it's collected written letters from climate scientists describing their feelings about their work. And one of them wrote, "It is probably the first time that I've been asked to describe what I feel rather than what I think about climate change." And then all of these letters include words such as overwhelmed, tired, fear, but also several references to hope and excitement. And I think that question of how scholars will be sort of presented as people who do know and can rescue us in certain ways, but nevertheless can tell stories about themselves and their work, I think will be a very interesting thing to watch in the coming years.
Sorry, one more thing. I wanted to add, there's a really interesting scientific paper by a guy called Jem Bendel, who went viral, which scientific papers very rarely do, about the climate emergency. And Vice picked it up and was like, this incredibly depressing scientific paper is sending people to therapy. This is obviously not very good for people who've come here for some kind of respite, but read it. Because he's like, he was a university in the UK, and he said, "I've had to take a sabbatical to write this because if I was in my normal day job, I wouldn't be able to present it like I want to," which is to say the reason that people aren't maybe taking this emergency seriously is because it's always presented as, you know, when you talk about science, you can't predict the future. You have to say there may be, because no one knows what the future will be. And he wrote a paper where he was like, okay, there may be, but then, like, this is also how I feel. This is how I feel from my research. And he was like, that's actually what's needed often to act, is not just facts.
Yes, and I think in a way, I think the different things we're talking about, it's a call to new forms of narrative, which is one of the things that that you are working with. We've only got time for one more question, I'm afraid. I know there are lots of very... is there a microphone with someone? Yeah.
All right. My question is also about what we can do as individuals in this age of anxiety. I think that the problem that we're faced with is that many of the people who display these anxiety-provoking traits have power. I mean, even trolls who do not let us know their identity have power. And also, just noticing that people are being swayed by so-called experts. It's just amazing to me how in the world today so many people can be swayed by so-called experts. There are numerous examples. The anti-vaxxers are an example of it. And my question is, do you think we need to call on individually new traits within ourselves you can think of that we should be practicing more in the face of anxiety in our society?
Resilience is certainly a good place to start, I think.
Well, I can only speak personally to this, but I have tried various things to cope with, manage my own anxiety. And I think one of the things that I have realised is helpful is that there is no fix and there is no cure, and despite the roaring wellness trade, it's not going to disappear. And that, for example, the CBT or the cognitive behavioral therapy that I've had that's actually been useful has just been about, it's like providing you with sort of mental maps so you can see these automatic things that you do, and this is the thing, slow that down in the moment. So when you do that automatic knee-jerk reaction, the CBT therapist I had was so good at actually almost making me draw what happened in my mind at that point. And when it's like watching something in slow motion, you can see like how the athlete's body actually moves and what it's actually doing in order to make that movement. And so for me, that was incredibly helpful. And it's like, it's almost like a hacker mentality, like interventionist moments where you feel yourself basically making a knee-jerk reaction is to sort of slow down. But I also would say that, speaking to what you mentioned at the very beginning, something that you mentioned in your book as well, is that, for example, with PTSD, you talk about how there is actually something worse than pain, which is lack of control. And I think that's what's so difficult for people with anxiety, is that a lot of people could have a really horrible, painful, terrible experience. So you talk about people who are in car crashes, but actually not all of those people will get PTSD from being in the car crash. The thing that's more likely to give you that is actually if you were trapped in the car, or if you had something that made you feel completely out of control. And so I think that one of the things that, you mentioned power, one of the things that characterizes anxiety is feeling powerless and like out of control. And I think when you start, that's why it was so good for me to go on that march, is that even though it was like a tiny action, it made me feel like I have some power. Someone interviewed me and I was like a loud mouth and probably like, you know, there's probably some like red pill all male forum out there like trolling me right now. But it made me feel good at the time. It made me feel like I had some power and like I could reclaim that.
And I think one of the things actually insomnia does really well in answer to this question is recasting experience.
It's a way of taking ownership. It's recasting experience. I'll just give you a very small example. So from insomnia, which is that... So capitalism demands that we have a healthy workforce, so we all need to be kind of, you know, well-slept and well-tended like you know, healthy little plants when we go into work in the morning. And for that, they prescribe that we get an 8 hours solid sleep. Again, like Olivia was saying about being very fortunate as a writer, I don't need to show up for work and kind of put my chit into the clock or whatever. So... I've actually lent in to the, I've gone with the flow, I've gone with the grain of the insomnia and actually decided to sleep differently. So I habitually now sleep, do two sleeps and wake up and do stuff in the middle for several hours.
Which is how it used to sleep.
So it's about reframing the experience so that you actually take some control over it. Sorry, what did you say? Olivia?
Isn't that how we used to sleep?
It is like how
in the 16th century, people would like receive visitors to their
and,
bed.
And, yeah, and I would like to keep talking about that, but this sort of speaking of time, various messages are flashing up before me.
So I
feel that we are out of time. This is the most anxious-inducing thing.
Yes, I know. So,
there's a lot of zeros in red on that screen.
That's about to be a bomb.
I would like to thank our panelists. I thought it was really fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.